Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Esperdahl. On today's show, we have some conflicting data that came out this week. It's kind of fun to talk about. We have a What Can Brown Do For You story. Yep. We're going to talk to a person with Arconic, and we're talking about the aluminum mill that we had visited. We have an interview with him. And we're going to talk about the Ford F-150 Platinum 2017 edition. I had it this week. I went goose hunting with it. It is a fantastic truck. We have all that on this week's show. First, let's talk about the conflicting data. That's always a fun thing to talk about, isn't it? Was it yesterday? I think it was the 2017 J.D. Power Vehicle Dependability Study came out. Now, this study, what they do is they talk to 35,000 original owners of a 2014 model year vehicles. And they talk to them after 3 years of ownership, and they basically have a survey, and they ask them what went wrong. They field the answers from October through December of 2016. And the idea is that way, when you're talking to the owners, you can really find out what happened with the vehicle and how dependable it is after 3 years. So they did this survey, and they found out that the best midsize truck for dependability is the Honda Ridgeline, and second would be the Nissan Frontier. For a large, light-duty pickup, they had the highest rank was a Ford F-150, then Toyota Tundra, then a tie with a Silverado and the Ram 1500. And then large heavy-duty pickup, they had the Chevy Silverado Heavy Duty, the GMC Sierra Heavy Duty, and the Ford Super Duty. There's some interesting things there. So let's go back to midsize. I said Honda Ridgeline, and I said Nissan Frontier. Do you know something's missing there? Yeah. The one that sells all the most? Yeah, the really popular one? Yeah, it's the... It's a Toyota Tacoma. It's nowhere on there. And Toyota's whole emphasis is on QDR, quality, dependability, and reliability. So where'd it go? I think that's a very interesting question. And they actually have an asterisk next to that one because they said no other model in this segment performs above segment average. And so, also, that's the GM twins. Now, the GM, I'm trying to remember if the Chevy Colorado or GMC Canyon were offered in 2014. I believe they were. I believe it was 15 they took the year off. I could be wrong with that. But that's still only two models are listing there and not listing to Tacoma. It's very interesting. We're going to get more to that in a minute. With the large light-duty pickup truck, F-150 ranked first. That's impressive. Beating the Toyota Tundra, which is known, again, another Toyota product known for the quality. And so it's pretty interesting how that turned out. And it's really interesting, a side note, in just a minute, and then you have the large heavy duty, the four Super Duty finishing last. That's not good. The Super Duty is made to be tough. I'm surprised it finished last, but I know why. Because JD Power measures all sorts of things, including a category that's called audio, communication, entertainment, and navigation. You know, that's your infotainment system. That's all it is. And so we know from prior experience, and you probably know by now, if you listen to the show, that the sync system, when Ford first came out, got destroyed in dependability surveys. Just destroyed, just hammered. And so it makes sense that they would get hammered on that kind of stuff. The more technology you have, the more people consider that a dependability problem, which is bizarre to me. Here's a statement from J.D. Power. For the third consecutive year, the problems most reported by owners are Bluetooth pairing, connectivity, and built-in voice recognition misinterpreting commands. You know, I talk to engineers all the time, and they spend thousands of dollars and hours and actually probably millions of dollars developing dependable powertrains, engine, transmission, make sure the door is shut right. They put them on shaker tables, and they beat the trucks to heck, just trying to make sure they last. And when the consumer gets it, they complain about Bluetooth not connecting. It doesn't equal up the two different things. Now, Bluetooth connecting is a big deal. Don't get me wrong. It's a big deal for a lot of consumers. But still, when you're spending that much time on the bones of the vehicle, if you will, to have a connectivity problem or to have a technology problem has got to drive these engineers nuts. And that's really what we have here. And so I want to go back to what I said earlier about the F-150. And the reason I brought that up the way I did is that Ford in the last couple of years has really started doing a lot with technology. However, that's in 2015 model. And the 2016 and 2017 model. The 2017 model it's had was one of the most technology equipped trucks I've ever been in. But you go back to 14, and 14 is when they had the sync system. So it really surprises me that that truck finished so high when you versus, like, say, a Toyota Tundra, which is known as one of the least technology-equipped vehicles. And I don't say that as a knock on Toyota. They have a lot of technology in their truck. It's just compared to the competition, they don't do the same level of technology. And so it surprises me that that is how those reports came out. I'd love to dig deeper, get more survey data, but I don't have access to that. The other thing that's interesting that came out with the survey was that they said that new to the top 10 list of problems reported in 2017 is battery failure. Yeah, car battery failure. In fact, 44% more owners reported a battery failure this year than in 2016. I've never heard of car batteries being that big of an issue. Typically, that's something that, gosh, we've almost forgot about these days. You know, brand new vehicle, you don't think about the battery. And in 3 years, you had to replace a battery? Wow, that is surprising. So I wrote a story. It's up on pickuptrucktalk.com. And my biggest question with this whole story is I wonder how the survey results would have turned out if they took technology out of the equation and talk about it so much. That'd be interesting to me. And oh, wait, we actually do have an answer to that. Yes, we do. Vincentric came out with a survey this week. They're an automotive, they call themselves an automotive data provider. So for the last 13 years, they've been doing these surveys. What they look at 5-year histories of vehicles sold in all the 50 states and of Colombia. And they use the sales history. They calculate the average for purchase price, depreciation, insurance, operating costs, including repairs, maintenance, and fuel, financing, state fees, and taxes. They put all that stuff together in a 5-year history. And what they're looking for here is the lowest cost of ownership, lowest real-world cost of ownership. So the J.D. Power Dependability Survey said, what happened last 3 years? What went wrong? This survey says, which one's the cheapest to own based on how much it cost, how much it depreciated, and how much you spent in repairs. So let's dig into this. So Vincentric found that in the small pickups, which is their terminology, we call midsize, they call them small, the Toyota Tacoma finished first. Ridgeline was second, and GMC Canyon was third. The Ridgeline's interesting to include in this because it's a brand new truck for this year, and the previous model was more of a full-size that had the power of a midsize, kind of an interesting vehicle. So they said that the Toyota Tacoma had an average cost of ownership per year, $8,984. It's not bad. So there you have it. So on the one hand, the Tacoma didn't even place, didn't get even in the category of being able to be listed, meet the even minimum amount in the J.D. Power Vehicle Dependability Survey. However, they are, according to this other survey, they are the lowest cost of ownership to own. So let's go to Half-Ton. Half-Ton in the J.D. Power, remember, was F-150. What was the next one I said? Toyota Tundra, Chevrolet Silverado, Ram 1500 were tied. So we have F-150, Toyota Tundra, J.D. Power, and in Vincentric we have Toyota Tundra, F-150, Chevy Silverado. So poor Silverado finished third twice. So that's kind of what they did. But they flipped this. So the Toyota Tundra had the average cost of ownership per year of $10,379. And they don't list the F-158. I'm trying to dig a little bit deeper to find that. And then you go into the heavy duties. What's interesting with Vincentric is they separate the 3/4 ton from the 1 tons. And the 3/4 ton, the Silverado 2500, was the winner, like it was before, I believe, in the J.D. Power, but they combined stuff together. So Vincentric did 3/4. They did Silverado at $12,293, Ram and Ford Super Duty. And the 1 ton, they did Ford Super Duty, average cost of $12,524, Silverado, and Ram 3500. So no really clear winner there. What's interesting with these two studies is, on the one hand, J.D. Power surveyed 35,000 people, which is statistically a pretty good survey segment of people. I'm sure my statistical analysis people would tell me that is a a big enough sample size to do their survey on. And then you have Vincentric that looked at all of them, every vehicle sold. And so, I don't know. It's interesting how they conflict. Interesting how they conflict. It doesn't give the consumer a very clear picture, I tell you that much. Next, let's talk about what Brown can do for you. And what Brown is going to do for you is it's going to deliver your package to your door with a drone. If you haven't heard about the story yet, it's kind of a crazy story. So drones have been out there, and we've been using them in different applications. We've seen a lot of them in automotive. We have these images now on top of the car where you can looking down at the car, and as we drive along the road, you can see on the top of the car. Well, that's all drones shooting the camera footage. And so what UPS has been working on is they've been working on a delivery system for rural deliveries. And the idea is the truck has a bay on top of it that opens up, and the drone flies off of this drone helipad, I guess you'd call it, and it can drive, it can fly. It's called the Workforce Horsefly UAV, Octopter, whatever. Basically, what it does is the driver loads a package, and then the drone flies the package to that person's house. And they say rural in the sense that, so many times in the country, you don't live right along the street corner, right? Or right along the street. You live farther back. You have a driveway. So if you think about all the time that the delivery driver spent going up and down driveways versus just driving up the street, you can save a pretty massive amount of time. So I know I lived in Michigan for many years. I've lived in Colorado, different places, and we have some long driveways. And so the idea is that the UPS van would stop. Driver equips the package up to 10 pounds in the drone. The drone flies off, comes over, lands, drops the package off of your door, and then flies back to the truck. And what's really cool with this idea is that the driver can just keep driving. The drone makes the delivery. Driver goes next house. The drone has a total runtime of about 30 minutes, which is a pretty good amount of time. And it can go drop the package and then meet the truck en route as it's going. And so they've been working on this. The UPS has been on the experimental basis for different ideas. They've been working on, kind of a cool thing about the story was they have been delivering vaccines in remote areas of Rwanda for many years, and that's how they're doing it. They load the vaccines up in the package and fly in with the drone, drop the vaccine off, and fly back. And so I kind of like this more than the Amazon idea, where Amazon's going to drop packages off with a drone, and I guess it's kind of the same idea. It could be the future. Instead of the doorbell ringing, you'll hear the drone fly up to your door. So, just a crazy news on what Brown can do for you. And we're right back with more. And we're right back with John Thomas. He is with Arconic. They used to be Alcoa. They are the aluminum manufacturer. They produce the milled aluminum for the F-Series and the new Expedition Ford products. And we're back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Espradal. On today's episode, we have a great interview with John Thomas. He's the Global Marketing Manager for Arconic. He's on the phone right now. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, Tim. Thanks. We're really happy to be talking to you today.
If you don't know what Arconic is and you don't have any clues going on, which maybe you don't, I was in Davenport last week. Arconic has a mill out there. They used to be part of Alcoa, and they split a couple years ago. And so why I'm talking about Arconic on the show is that Arconic makes the aluminum that turns into gets stamped somewhere else and becomes the body panels on the Ford F-Series of trucks. So it's the basic start of all the aluminum panels comes from Arconic. And it's a huge facility there. It's a 6.5 million square feet. John and I were just talking about that. You said it was 18 holes of golf, like under inside.
You walk around the facility and it's massive right on the Mississippi there in Davenport. And so that was one of the stats is that it's as big as an 18-hole golf course underneath the roof. So it's astounding. It's industry, United States industry on a massive scale.
Yeah, well, you have to have that size because the big coals or coils of aluminum. So let's give people the scene here. So it's along the Mississippi River in Davenport, and do the ships bring the ingots in the aluminum, or how do we start the process?
Actually, a lot of it comes on truck and by train, and we bring in, you know, pure aluminum, and sometimes we bring in quite a bit of scrap as well, aluminum, and so we start our process in what's called ingot casting. So it's kind of like making cookies when you're making aluminum alloys. You know, if you're going to make chocolate chip cookies, you're going to put in a certain amount of flour, a certain amount of eggs, a certain amount of, you know, salt and sugar in chocolate chips. It's kind of the same thing with aluminum on a very basic level, right? We use pure aluminum, which makes up, you know, the vast majority of the content. But then depending on the alloy that we make, we add different elements like manganese or magnesium or zinc to get the different properties that we use for the products that we make for our customers. So we cast these huge ingots. We melt them, melt the aluminum in these big furnaces. They're as big as a house. And we cast these into what are called ingots. And basically, if you think of an ingot, you saw them, Tim.
Yep.
They're basically huge slabs of aluminum that can be up to a couple feet thick, maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 feet wide, and sometimes 40 feet long. And we roll these down and ultimately roll them into coil.
And so to give people an idea of these ingots, they look like huge concrete slabs. If you like took a piece of the road and cut up into big squares or rectangles, that's what it looks like. It's really thick. It's really, and some of those were really long, and really heavy. I took some notes. I thought some of the notes were, some of the smaller ones were up around 10 to 12,000 pounds, and the bigger ones got over 30,000 pounds.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, you're exactly right. So normally a coil of aluminum can, you know, for an automotive application, again, depending on how wide it is for the customer's application, can be, like you said, anywhere between usually 12 and 25,000 pounds. And you're usually limited in the coils that you can make because of over-the-road trucking for the coils of aluminum in the United States.
Yeah, sure. And so then these ingots go down the line and they get hot. Was it hot milled and cold milled, or hot pressed, cold pressed? Hot pressed. Pressed.
Yep. Hot rolled and cold rolled. That's exactly right. So if you want to think about our hot rolling, if you imagine this huge, big, rectangular, thick piece of aluminum, and it goes through different steps in a mill. And a mill is nothing more than a really, really large machine, you know, that can be 3 stories underground and maybe 4 or 5 stories high above ground, massive machines that basically have huge rollers, and you squeeze this aluminum, and the hot mills are called reversing mills because that ingot will roll forward, and then the operator will roll it backward, and each time they squeeze it down a little bit more. So just like, you know, if you want to simplify it, like you're playing with Play-Doh, and you roll it out, it doesn't get any wider, but it's certainly get longer, right?
Yep.
So you roll it down to gauge, and you keep doing that step until you finally send it through what's called a cold mill. What a cold mill does is now it's pretty much at the final gauge or pretty close to it, and it's going to impart certain physical properties inside of the metal when you squeeze that down. And ultimately, sometimes we can even put a what's called a texture on the material as well.
And then it goes over to the... Yes.
I was going to say, if you've ever seen, like, the diamond plate, like, on different vehicles, big rigs, and, you know, some even trucks, bumpers, and toolboxes, that's what you get. You can get in the cold mill is that diamond plate. And I think the Davenport mill makes a vast majority of the diamond plate that's actually used in the United States today as well.
Yeah, I saw some of that diamond plate in a huge roll. It makes sense. I was like, wow, I'd never thought about where diamond plate comes from. It's at the store.
That's right, Davenport, Iowa.
So then it goes to the automotive side. So the people understand with Arconic is that you do a lot of aerospace and automotive. It's a dual purpose facility. So the automotive side, does it get thin? I'm trying to remember now. It's been a long week. Sorry, folks. I've had a long week. It goes to the automotive process. I know that we have the secondary process is the 951. Let's say it's an A. It gets an applied coating to it, but. So does it go through and get thinned out again? I'm trying to remember how that works.
No, so after cold mill, it's at final gauge. So after cold mill, depending on the alloy that you're going to use, if it's a heat-treatable alloy or what we call a 6000 series for automotive, it would go through our heat treater at Davenport, or we've got heat treaters also at our Tennessee facility just south of Knoxville, and also in Danville, Illinois, which is the southern part of Illinois, just west of Indianapolis. So what we do there with heat treating is we impart heat to the coil, and what that does is really what makes aluminum the miracle metal. So what heat treatable sheet is when you run it through the heat treater, it comes out of the heat treater and it's fairly soft. And our customers like that because then they can make the complex shapes when they stamp these parts, making a fender or a roof or a hood or a door or something like that. They can use that material while it's soft. Well, because of the chemistry of the metal and because of the heat treat process, as time goes on, and when it goes through our customer's paint oven, so after they assemble a vehicle and they send it through paint and they send it through an oven, that aluminum actually gets harder over time. So that's where you get the strength. So it's soft when you form it and hard when you use it, and that's what our customers want. So we do that at our facilities. And then just like you said, Tim, we also do the application of a proprietary process that we've actually licensed called Arconic 951. And this is a treatment on the aluminum that allows it to be bonded one piece to the next and have extreme bond durability, much greater than if you were just going to glue it together, untreated. The Arconic 951 chemical treatment process actually improves the bond strength and really the bond durability. So how long that bond when our customers glue some of the aluminum together before they use self-piercing rivets sometimes as well to try to get that bond to be the best it can, and there's nothing better than the Arconic 951 for doing that.
Yeah, and isn't that the crux of the whole thing? Is once you got that 951 patented and figured out, that Ford was able to go forward with the F-Series?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, we've been working on Arconic 951 for quite a long time. It was really the advent of Ford going with the F-150 that we really started to use it on a massive scale. We had used it before, but in the United States on a massive scale with the F-150. And our customer, Ford included, was very, very happy with the performance of their joints after they used the 951. And of course, there are competitors out there to the Arconic 951, but they just don't get the bond durability that we get. And Ford liked it so much that they wanted us to use it, and they wanted us to license it too, so we did.
Okay.
So everybody can use it now.
Right. And I'm trying to remember, one of the cons I've thought to aluminum was in the creases as you stamp out the creases and things. But doesn't a 951 doesn't help that bonding to keep that crease strong? Like around the door panels? Like around the door panel or around like the door panels where they join together, or like the door handle?
Oh, the hem. Yeah. So, yeah. So in the 951 in that case, it was called a hem. You basically fold one piece of aluminum over the edge of another, like on the front of your hood, for example. If you were to lift up the hood of your car, you'd look at the underside of that, and you can see kind of where one part's folded over on the top.
Yeah.
It's actually a mechanical joint, so 951 isn't necessarily used there. Where 951 is used is in, like on the F-150, for example, in structural applications where they're going to take one of the pieces of the structure of the body, so not necessarily a panel, an outer panel, like a hood or a door, but something that, is the structure of the vehicle, and they're going to use adhesive to glue those together and also mechanically fasten them together. That's where the 951 is applied before that adhesive is applied, and it ultimately makes that joint the strongest it can be.
Hmm. So besides Davenport, I know you alluded to a Nashville facility south of Nashville there. Wasn't there a plant in Pennsylvania as well?
Yeah, so just south of Knoxville is our Tennessee operations. It's actually in a town called Alcoa, Tennessee, named after the original Alcoa Company, Aluminum Company of America. And then we've got a facility, a mill as well in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, probably about an hour or so west of Philadelphia. And we don't do heat-treatable sheet there, but we also do other products. So we do what are called 5000 series alloys, so non-heat treat. And we also do quite a bit of brazing products. So this is multi-layer, very high-technology material that we sell for evaporators and condensers in both automotive and industrial settings for heat exchangers and coolers and things like that.
Okay. All right. So now we know how the process works. Let's talk a little bit about the split, the Arconic and Alcoa, and where what has changed since 2009 and 14 when the truck came to the marketplace. So for people understanding, Alcoa and Arconic are separate companies these days. And if I read the stuff correctly, I believe Alcoa is focused now on like more consistent, slower growth aluminum opportunities, and Alcoa is based, or Arconic is based on faster moving industries like aerospace and automotive. Is that how you read things?
I wouldn't really look at it that way. What I would do is I would talk about Alcoa and Arconic of maybe two sides of the same coin, right?
Okay.
When we were all under the same roof as Alcoa, we did everything basically from soup to nuts, right? We dug the bauxite out of the ground in our mining operations. We had smelting operations around the world that took that bauxite and refined it into alumina and then ultimately, smelted it into pure aluminum. And then we sold that on the open market, but we also, do the things that Arconic does now. We've got rolling operations. We've got our EPS, which handles, that division handles, titanium and engine components for aircraft and, very high-tech fasteners. We've got extrusions and castings as well. So really what the Arconic and Alcoa split did, and it was, we haven't been Arconic very long. The split happened on November 1st of last year. But really what it did is it separated the two companies into what each of them did well, right? So Alcoa was originally really good at the mining, the smelting, and the refining. So they retained the majority of that business. Whereas Arconic, as we call the downstream business or the value-add business, was more of a midstream to downstream. So we're not digging it out of the ground anymore, but we're using that product in our rolling divisions. We're using that product in our casting and our extrusion divisions to make products like, wheels for forged wheels for trucks. We make fasteners for all the big airlines. We make sheet and plate for both automotive, industrial, marine, building and construction, and aerospace as well. So really, it's those downstream operations that became Arconic, and we call that the value-add business because it's not just the commodity-type business of digging up bauxite and turning it into aluminum, but it's how do we use the materials that we use. And it's really not necessarily just about aluminum anymore. Like I mentioned, Arconic does work in titanium. We've got additive manufacturing that we're bringing to market now. So it's really more of a multi-material business now than it was. Obviously, aluminum is certainly core to our business and very dear to our hearts.
I got to go with the moneymaker, right? You got to keep that going. I wanted to talk a little bit about the recession, and I've watched some interviews recently with your CEO. There's a slight issue going on with this Elliott management, but I don't want to talk about that at all. People can look that up later. But he was talking about how the commodities market had kind of crashed in 2009, and post-recession was kind of a down market. Looking at timing-wise, it seems like Ford's use of the F-150 with aluminum was quite the savior for Arconic. Or Alcoa, actually, at the time, and Arconic. I was talking to Davenport, and they said they invested $300 million in their facility there to increase aluminum or the increase production for automotive. How much of an impact has automotive had, and the F-150 had on Arconic?
We've always been in automotive, and we've been supplying sheet for our customers, the big three and others, for decades. But quite frankly, it really wasn't until people started being more concerned about fuel prices, people starting to be more concerned about safety and performance, that really things started to really accelerate. And like you said, it's no secret the F-150 going to an all-aluminum or what we call aluminum-intensive vehicle certainly was a boon to our business. We were chugging along. I mean, the recession hit everybody hard, in the 2007, 2008 timeframe. But you've seen the OEM customers come back, and certainly we came back as well, and we certainly got some tailwinds by being a part of the team with Ford on the F-150.
Sure. So let's look at the future. So you guys are doing different, you have different metals, you're doing titanium, you're doing different stuff. There were some comments about a micro mill. I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well. What are we, aluminum, we've done aluminum for a while now, but what's the future looking like?
It's a multi-material world, and the funny funny thing is you'll hear our competitors in steel say the exact same thing. I don't think that the world is going to go with all aluminum vehicles. I think what the OEMs are realizing is that they've got material choices now that are, far outweigh what they were able to do with product and process even 10 to 15 years ago. So the advancements in our technology, you mentioned our micromill business. So our micromill, we actually won the R&D Top 100 Award in 2016. We've got micromill material on the F-150 actually coming out. And what the micromill does is it allows us to make, a stronger and more formable aluminum alloy than you can make in the process that we just talked about at Davenport or Tennessee or Lancaster. Suffice it to say that moving forward in aluminum, you're going to see a lot more of it. I don't necessarily think every car is going to go aluminum, but I can also say that not every car is going to be all steel anymore either. So our customers are starting to use the right material in the right place, and they're realizing now the benefits that they can get by using sheet aluminum in their vehicles allows them to make trucks, for example, that accelerate better, right, because they're lighter. They're more fuel efficient. I think the EcoBoost V6 engine is by far and away the top-selling engine in the F-150 line. And if you've ever driven one, I drove the 2.7-liter EcoBoost, and I was astounded at how quick it was, And that's all because they can use, more efficient technologies to either meet or exceed the performance characteristics in the vehicle that they, had before that they had to use maybe a 5-liter, V8 or a 6.2-liter to get. So you've got better acceleration, you've got a better braking, better hauling, and better towing, and ultimately the customer who buys the truck is in a better position because they're spending less money on gas as well. So there's no downside. If you're a customer buying an F-150 or you're buying a Cadillac CT6 or, any of the Chrysler Pacifica's got a lot of aluminum on it too. So it's really, the market is certainly responding to a multi-material world, and aluminum is certainly a part of that.
And are you thinking, are you of the opinion that micromill is probably the biggest advancement that you've learned over the last 3-4 years developing aluminum for Ford on a massive scale? I mean, when you go to a massive scale, you learn new things because you're doing it all the time now, right?
Yeah, the funny thing is the micromill came out, we have been working on that technology for quite a long time, and it actually predates the business that we had with Ford on the F-150. But to answer your question, micromill is certainly the most technologically advanced way to make aluminum in the world as we sit here today. It's really quite a game changer in the types of products that it produces and the speed at which it produces it and the flexibility that we get being able to provide different products to our customers that exceed what they can do even with the stuff that they're buying from our competitors in steel or even standard aluminum grades.
And you said that was on the new truck, so the 17 or the 18?
The current F-150, it's as it stands today, has micromill material on it. Okay. And actually, Ford was the first automaker to put this this type of material made with our process on a production vehicle.
And they were really the first guys to test it out on the mass scale. And go through the criticism that a lot of journalists and investors have made about going aluminum on a vehicle. It wasn't just a fly by the seat of your pants decision. I mean, this was some risk involved. I haven't seen anything as far as downsides yet. It seems like it's been a positive for them.
I think as the sales numbers, I think, really speak for themselves, and I'm not going to even begin to try to speak for Ford. I mean, they've got enough success stories on this vehicle and their other vehicles in their lineup that they don't need me, preaching for them. But I will say that if you just look at the production numbers and the sales numbers for the F-150, I mean, they are just knocking the lights out on this thing. So it's been a massive success for them.
All right, so let's talk about keep knocking the lights out and keep selling lots of stuff. There was some discussion when this first got started going about some capacity constraints with aluminum production, that there's a finite supply in nature, there's not a huge industry like there was with steel producing parts and things. How are we doing with aluminum production? Do we have more capacity to have more automakers go with aluminum?
Yeah, I don't think capacity is an issue. I think our Arconic has certainly shown, as you mentioned earlier, you know, our willingness to invest to meet the growing demand. So, you know, $300+ million in Davenport, Iowa, a huge multi-million-dollar expansion at our Tennessee facility. And quite frankly, it's not just us. You know, you look in the news and some of our competitors have put in extra capacity in North America as well to support the growing need. And it's a worldwide market, and it's certainly a worldwide production scenario, and it's growing really in all markets.
So you're going to have plenty of aluminum, so when the world goes aluminum, were you ready for it?
That's right. We want to sell as much as we can and help our customers make better products.
That's fantastic. And thanks for being on the show today, and we'll be right back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And finally, I want to talk about the 2017 Ford F-150 Platinum Edition that I had for the past week. I had it in the ruby red metallic tinted exterior, so really a nice deep red color. It was the Platinum Edition, so it had all the different features to it, like the retractable side steps, like the color matching front bumper with the fog lights built into it. Lots of great chrome accents all the way through it. Inside was just fully loaded leather seats. It had the trailer backup assist, I guess, in the rear. You're always going to do it in the rear. Full of features inside. The Sync 3 system, which is much improved over the previous Sync system. Just lots of features, and it was really fun to drive. It had the 3.5-liter V6 EcoBoost in it, which, if you haven't driven that engine, I've had some good experience with it now. Fortunately, this is my second or third Ford F-150. Now, I'm going to say my third one. It may be my second. Ford doesn't do a lot with the press fleet, so I don't get the chance to have them in loan very often. But I will say that driving it, it gives you that, you can't say need for speed, but you can say that it's really a thrilling drive. It really is a fun drive. It's almost more sports car than it is truck driving. You're not waiting for the engine to spool up. You're not waiting for the big V8 to get going. You're not worrying about that weight at all. It's really quick off the line. Just is a really fun drive, really smooth drive too. I was surprised at how quiet it was and how smooth it was. If you've driven any of the Chevrolet or GMC products lately, you know that they're trying to go very quiet in their interior cabs. And Ford is really close. I don't know that they are the same level of a Chevy or GMC, but I think I'd be hard pressed to tell the difference between the two models. I don't think that the sound quality from road noise is that much different. I do think the Ford's a slight bit more, but even then, it's you got to be a critic like myself to really analyze that sound quality difference. I will say it's one of the more fun to drive engines out there, just from that aspect of off the line speed and how much fun it is to corner, and it's just a fun driving truck. I would say it's, like I said, more like sports car than anything else. The downside, of course, the 3.5-liter EcoBoost is the reverse sound quality. You know, you're not going to get that deep rumble from the exhaust. You're not going to get that exhaust sound. It's not possible. It's not going to happen. There's not enough displacement there in the engine to make that possible, to get the noise out of it. And I have towed with it. So I think that's always the question with the 3.5-liter is, can you tow with it? I have neighbors who tow with it. I have my uncle who has one and he tows with it. I got to tell you, it'll do it. It'll do it just fine. It's not an everyday towing truck, though. It's an occasional towing truck. If you're going to tow a lot, that's definitely the 5-liter V8 you want to go with, not the 3.5-liter. But it does all right. It does all right. The only knock I do have on the engine and the... this was the 10-speed transmission, too, which I drove that elsewhere. So the 10-speed with the V6, I still can't get the fuel economy. I still can't get it. I drove 120 miles with the truck and back and forth the farm a few times, dirt roads. A highway was 70 miles, 65 miles an hour. It's kind of the speed I go. and I got 18 miles a gallon. The EPA estimates are 17 city, 23 highway, and 20 combined. I would have guessed with my driving, I should have been more than 20, 22 range. Now, granted, I drove it like I wanted to drive it. I had fun with it, and that's probably burned a lot more fuel than I would have in the EPA cycle. But I have a hard time getting the fuel economy of the Ford products, the EcoBoost. I just can't seem to get, my numbers just don't match. And the reality is I can't get those numbers to match because of the way I drive, probably. Once you get the fun to drive and offline speed, you're really in the turbo. And when you're in the turbo, you're burning fuel. And the idea would be to make sure you're out of the turbo as much as possible. So you're gliding up the stop signs, you're slow on the takeoff, you know, you do those kind of things. And I probably get those numbers better. I tend to bring it up with Ford products, especially EcoBoost, just so people know that you have to change your driving style a little bit to get those numbers. Beyond that, you know, that I don't have a problem with that, right? 18.8 in a full-size truck, especially that as a crew cab with a 5.5-foot bed, and it was a four-wheel drive. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's fine. It had the 355 rear end, surprising to me because it did have the towing package too, I thought. Yeah, the max towing trailer package with a 36-gallon extended range fuel tank. So, you know, I have quite a bit of weight in there with the, when you get it full of fuel with 36 gallons plus the 355 in the rear. I'm surprised it's not a stauncher one, but that's okay. And then, you know, it was a platinum group, so it had the technology package, 360-degree camera, adaptive cruise control, and it had the tailgate step. I always get mixed on the tailgate step. I actually did use it a couple times. I wanted to really play with it and see how it worked. It's quite a few steps to get it going, but it is, wow, it's, you know, you get the, you really can climb into the bed. It's really easy to get in and out of the bed. It's a mix for me. So you have the Chevrolet bumper step, and the GMC has the bumper step on it. Bumper step is quicker, faster to get into bed, but you got to hop over the tailgate, and it's not useful at all when the tailgate's down. Flip that around, you have the Ford tailgate step where you can press the button and make, it's a two-button thing. You press one, it pops out from underneath the tailgate, inside the tailgate. Another one, you put up an arm, and then that's how you climb into it. So, not as fast as the bumper step. You get a little more steps to get it out. Easier to get in and out. However, it only works the tailgate down. So, you can't just hop in the bed and just get something out. You got to put the tailgate down and get the step out and get into it. So, it's a little more, you know, definitely intensive than it is just hopping in the Chevy bed. So I don't know what I think either way, whether ones are better than the other. Oh, I was going to read off my, I'm reading off my Monroney here, which is the sheet they put out on the side of the trucks. Now, we get them copies of those too. So you have a base price of the F-150 with the 56,260 in the setup I had. The 3.5 liter V6, the electric 10 speed, the four-wheel drive, 145-inch wheelbase. Coming back to 10-speed, there's no problem here. There's no hunting for gears. There's no feeling the gear shifting. What I felt more often is that it just quickly goes through gears faster. And so it's a little bit faster up the line, but it's just goes through those gears faster. Give those that highway fuel economy is what kind of you're going for. Total options were $8,495, if I read that right. The print's a little hard to see. Maybe that's a six. $6,495. That makes more sense. And that was your platinum package, your ruby paint, $395 for that. The EcoBoost engine upcharge was $500. The 10-speed transmission upcharge was $500. The max trailer tow package, $1,195, which has the bigger fuel tank. It had the powered mirrors. They were the big towing mirrors. That's $250 for those. Active park assist, which is $440. I've done the active park assist in different vehicles for Ford. The Ford Edge comes to mind. It's all right. I don't know that I'm a big need of that here in Western Nebraska. I think maybe in downtown New York City or in LA you'd need that, but I guess you could use that. Wheel well liner, $180, and spray and bed liner is $495. So you put all those options together, you have destination and delivery fee of $1,195, and you're looking at $63,950, but Ford gives a couple discounts. They have a platinum luxury discount, a tech park cruise discount, and they got $1,000 off, so $62,950 is our total. It's one of those trucks that I was driving around thinking to myself, can I keep it? Can I keep it for a while? How much are these payments? How many hundreds of dollars a month are these payments? Yeah, I just it was really nice. It really was great. And it was nice with Ford on this is they're doing all the features in this. Like this is my goodness. If you took a this is a 2017, if you took a 2007 or heck a 1997 Ford F-150 and you took the Monroney from that and matched to this. You know, the 1997, you know, you may have gotten the package that had leather seats and heated steering, heated heat and air conditioning, and power windows and power locks. That was a big deal. And now I can't even. I don't have time to read you all the options that came with this on the podcast. I'd be another 25 minutes reading you all these options because they're so impressive and it's so useful. And every little thing that you may have had a minor issue with at one point down in your life owning a truck, they got an answer for it, and they've made it happen. Like, for good example, the locking removable tailgate. Yep, when you press the door locks, the tailgate locks. That's a handy damn feature because people steal tailgates all the time because they're not locked. There you go, boom, done. Problem solved. Moving on. So I would encourage you to go check it out. Go to your dealer and drive it. If you're looking for the F-150, you know, there's a reason they've been 39 years as a truck leader. That's why they had sell so many trucks. There's a reason why the EcoBoost is about 50% of their take rate right now on the F series. I think they're 40, 50%, some of that range, because it's a fun engine. It's a fun thing to drive. It's full of technology. It's very comfortable. And I want it back. And that's it for this week's edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. Make sure to join us on iTunes. I did the Stitcher thing this week, and I did the Google Music Play. So yeah, if you have one of those Android devices or you want to listen to your desktop, there's two choices there. You check us out on PickupTruckTalk.com. Check us out on Facebook on Pickup Truck Talk. Pickup blah, 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 Peter Piper. Pickup Truck Talk on Facebook. Find me on Twitter on T Estradol. Find me on Instagram on Tim.Estradol. And we'll see you down the road.